transmitting live from the heart of Times Square on 99.5 FM, WBAI New York, Pacifica Radio for the tri-state area. This is Trump Watch, a weekly series examining how President Donald J. Trump and his administration are changing the world we live in. I'm your host, Jesse Litt.
President Trump had sent President Abe to take a message of his to the leadership in Iran. You have to remember, these are messages for the leadership. I think the Iranian people are being woefully misserved by that leadership. But yes, we're engaged in, we have been engaged in many messages, even this moment right here, communicating to Iran that we are there to deter aggression. President Trump does not want war, and we will continue to communicate that message while doing the things that are necessary to protect American interests in the region.
That was Secretary of State Mike Pompeo speaking to reporters in Tampa, Florida on Tuesday from McGill Air Force Base, footage courtesy of CNN. As reported by NBC News, Pompeo had traveled to U.S. Central Command headquarters in Florida to meet with General Kenneth McKenzie, head of U.S. Central Command responsible for forces deployed in the Middle East, and General Richard Clark, head of U.S. Special Operations Command, about our military capabilities in the Persian Gulf following Monday's announcement that 1,000 additional U.S. troops would be deployed in the region. Though the visit to Central Command headquarters was an unusual one for a sitting Secretary of State, Pompeo brushed it off by saying he was simply saving the generals and their staff a trip to Washington. Hello and welcome to Trump Watch. All of this, of course, was in response to a June 13th attack that damaged two oil tankers in the Gulf of Oman that the U.S. government is claiming Iran is behind. With the rhetoric getting increasingly heated on both sides of the Atlantic, tonight we'll be looking at what we know about the incident and the response of both governments to it with Julian Borger, World Affairs editor for The Guardian and co-author with David Smith of the article Iran Will Not Wage War Against Any Nation, says Hassan Rouhani. He joins us now live on the phone. Hello, Julian. Welcome to Trump Watch. Thanks so much for taking some time for us today.
Good to be here.
Let's start with last week's attack on two tankers in the Gulf of Oman. According to the reports I've seen, the U.S. government's main argument is that Iran must be behind this because we have surveillance footage of an Iranian vessel collecting a mine from one of the ships, the Kukuka Courageous. Excuse me if I'm mispronouncing that. Am I getting that explanation correct? Can you walk us through the government's logic here?
Yes, they say that they have overhead surveillance footage of Iranian Revolutionary Guard boats approaching the two tankers that were hit in this incident. But they only have provided footage of what they say is an Iranian Revolutionary Guard patrol boat coming up alongside the Kukuka Courageous and one of the sailors taking off a limpet mine from the side of the hull and then moving away. They aren't giving a sort of narrative to accompany these images. They haven't said openly that they believe this is the Iranians seeking to cover up evidence after one mine failed to explode. They're just putting it out there, showing the juxtaposition of Iranian boats and these tankers.
What has the Iranian government's response been to these allegations? Has there been an admission or a denial that it is their ship in the video U.S. officials claim proves that Iranians are behind the attack?
No, they haven't gone into details, but they have denied responsibility for the attacks and pointed the finger elsewhere, raising questions of whether this is somehow a false flag or operation designed to upset any kind of opening dialogue with the U.S. So you've got to remember this happened at the same time that Shinzo Abe, the Japanese prime minister, was in Tehran seeking to set up some kind of dialogue between the Iranian leadership and Trump or the Trump administration. And when this happened, this obviously torpedoed, for want of a better word, this mediation effort. So the Iranian narrative is this is spoilers out there who don't want this crisis in the Gulf to the Gulf to be resolved.
And was Abe, he was actually specifically talking about ships as one of the areas he was discussing, correct?
My understanding is that the main point of his visit, he was coming with a message from Donald Trump saying that Trump was serious about the idea of dialogue. My understanding is that Abe's idea is that perhaps President Hassan Rouhani could have a meeting with Trump at the sidelines of the next UN General Assembly meeting in September. It's one of a number of avenues that the Trump administration has used to try and approach Tehran in terms of opening up some kind of dialogue. But what is not clear is what terms the Trump administration is putting on the table when it comes to restoring a dialogue. What the Iranians want to see is some softening of the oil embargo, of the sanctions, as a sweetener, if you like, before there is any kind of contact between the two capitals.
And of course, that message to Shinzo Abe, the Japanese prime minister, is what Pompeo was alluding to in the clip that we heard at the top of the show. Excuse me if this sounds incredibly naive, but is there any rational possibility that the Iranian ship was actually attempting to assist these vessels by removing the mine?
Yes, that is possible. The U.S. military has presented is an incomplete picture, and that is one possible interpretation of what we've been, what we've been shown so far. Certainly, they haven't presented a notorious smoking gun. Some countries have said they are convinced by the evidence. UK, Israel, the Germans recently said that they find the evidence compelling. But certainly what's been put in the public view is not a complete picture. It's not a conclusive, there's not conclusive evidence of Iranian responsibility for these attacks.
Right. As you just mentioned, the U.S. description of the attack, the categorization that it was Iran who did this, has received some pushback from our allies, at least initially. You mentioned that Germany appears to have possibly come around, but Japanese officials also have said the video is insufficient to make an assessment of blame, as the Washington Post reported on Sunday. Can you describe the broader international response to the way that this is unfolding?
Well, I think that the overwhelming international response is one of caution. Now, even if they were convinced or persuaded by the evidence of this attack, they don't want to get on a train that is leading towards conflict. They don't want to be drawn into a conflict that they see as springing out of a crisis that the U.S. created by walking out of the 2015 nuclear deal and then stepping up this embargo, this pressure on Iran. I mean, even before sending Abe with this message from Trump, a few days before, a week before, they notched up that pressure another step by imposing more sanctions on the petrochemical industry. The rest of the world sees where this is going and is very reluctant to be drawn in to a conflict and is looking for ways of defusing the situation.
Assuming that Iran is behind these attacks, one analysis that I've heard is that they're doing this to put pressure on Europe to offer relief from some of these U.S. sanctions, which, as you mentioned, have gotten particularly severe since we pulled out of the nuclear agreement in May of 2018. Do you agree with that analysis, or at least find it to be a possibility?
Yes, I do find it to be a possibility. A couple of months ago, in April, the Iranian foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, was in New York and really making this point, saying, if we can't get our oil out of the Gulf, why should other countries be able to? We are not going to take these costs, the costs of U.S. walking out of the nuclear deal, all on ourselves. This should be a cost and a risk that is shared with our other nations. So whether or not this is Iran in this case, it is something that Iran has publicly contemplated. that this is their leverage in terms of pushing back against this wall of pressure directed from Washington. And they see this as their main point of putting some pressure themselves on the Europeans, on China and Russia, to buy some of their oil, to take the pressure off. Because up to now, the U.S., the threat of secondary sanctions from Washington has deterred all of Iranian customers, even including China up to now, from stepping up their own purchases of Iranian oil. So Iran was really feeling the pressure. And clearly, some parts of the Iranian hierarchy believes it has no choice now other than to push back, lash out, and kind of spread the cost, spread the risk of this impending crisis.
Does the refusal of some of our allies to accept this narrative of what happened in the Gulf of Oman, does that tell us anything about the current state of U.S. credibility around the world?
Yes, the U.S. credibility is really, you know, I don't know if it's an all-time low. It's certainly probably at its lowest point since the Iraq invasion 2003. And again, you know, it's a matter of interpretation of evidence and also just interpretation of U.S. policy. I mean, most of the world, with very few exceptions, does not agree with the U.S. decision to leave the JCPOA, is resentful at U.S. pressure on their own companies, on their own economies, to make them also fail to uphold the 2015 agreement. Europe, Russia, and China are trying to honor that agreement by continuing to trade with Iran, buy its oil, but the U.S., having walked out of the agreement themselves, is trying to make it impossible for them to do so.
This may be an impossible question to answer, but is that credibility gone for good? Are we living in a post-second Iraq war WMD debacle world?
I think it's difficult to say anything is gone for good. I think credibility, you know, is always qualified by doubts and questions about national agendas. So, you know, it has definitely been damaged. It may take a very long time for it to be earned back. But I think it would be wrong to say, you know, it's gone for good.
I think that for many Americans old enough to remember the Vietnam War, the parallels between this incident in the Gulf of Oman and the Gulf of Tonkin attacks are difficult to ignore. For listeners who don't know, in 1960, there was a minor battle at sea in the Gulf of Tonkin, resulting in the death of 4 North Vietnamese sailors and no American casualties. The attack was blamed on the North Vietnamese, and a second attack was made up by the U.S. government. Both the imaginary and the exaggerated attack were used by President Lyndon Johnson's administration as a way to get congressional approval to escalate the war in Vietnam and, in fact, to pursue military action against any Southeast Asian country accused of, quote, communist aggression. Do you see any parallels here to the Gulf of Tonkin beyond the nautical setting?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, certainly this is an executive here who is seeking the power to wage war independently of Congress. And there is a battle underway between Congress and the presidency over whether the 2001 authorization to use military force in the wake of 9/11 attacks could apply here. And Congress, and certainly congressional Democrats, and many Republicans too, bridle at that, saying there's no way that 2001 AUMF covers any military action against Iran. But then the question is, what if in a future incident, U.S. servicemen are harmed, U.S. personnel are in the line of fire? You know, what happens then? What about an unplanned, inadvertent clash which suddenly escalates out of control? So there's a lot of concern that the administration is playing with fire here. I think one difference is, you have a president Donald Trump, who would rather not go to war. He, by all accounts, doesn't want to go to a war, and yet all the policies that he has brought in, walking out of the JCPOA, putting this pressure on, is leading towards a conflict. He seems to have been convinced by the people around him that if the U.S. puts on this this wall of pressure on Iran, they would bow and give him a better deal than the JCPOA, the 2015 deal. Now, most Iran experts could have told him from the get-go that that was not going to work, that the Iranian response would be to lash out. It would be to strengthen the hardliners and make a conflict more likely. There's signs that Trump is beginning to realize this, but he's sort of boarded this train that is bound in this direction, driven by people like John Bolton, National Security Advisor, who would have no compunction of entering into a conflict to further what he sees as U.S. interests. And so you have this situation where the U.S., where the president is trying to tamp this down, telling his own officials to watch their rhetoric and dismissing the tanker incident as very minor, while the momentum of the policies that he has approved is taking the U.S. towards this conflict. And the question is, can he get off the train before it reaches that destination?
I'm speaking with Julian Borger, World Affairs Editor for The Guardian. You're listening to Trump Watch. My name is Jesse Lent. Julian, you report in your article that Iranian President Hassan Rouhani said, quote, Iran will not wage war against any nation in a speech broadcast live on state TV on Tuesday. Do you feel this statement accurately expresses the views of his administration?
Yes, I think the administration, including the Revolutionary Guard, do not want a direct confrontation with the U.S. Because they know that the main loser, and then they wouldn't be winners, but the principal loser almost certainly would be Iran. Iran has a huge amount to lose, yet it has nothing to show for its agreement to put its nuclear program under severe constraints in 2015. It has, that has been, from its point of view, been betrayed by the U.S. and by the West, Western Europe, and China and Russia, who failed to step in to support Iran after the U.S. walked out. So Iran and the Iranian government certainly feels, it has been pushed up against the wall with very few options. And, the hardliners there in Iran, in the Revolutionary Guard, are arguing that it has to strike out somehow. But even the Revolutionary Guard is clearly being careful not to come into direct confrontation with the Americans, with the U.S. Navy in the Gulf. But it has come close over the tanker incidents. Iranian and U.S. ships came very, very close in proximity to one another when it came to picking up the crews from the tankers. So it is a very volatile situation in a narrow body of water where there is a lot of U.S. and Iranian firepower.
In terms of the U.S. narrative here, do you find it significant that of the two vessels attacked on June 13th, the Kokuka Courageous, a tanker owned by Japan and en route to Singapore, and the Front Altair, a Norwegian-owned tanker on its way to Taiwan, neither are American ships? This is a president who has not gone out of his way to appear friendly to most U.S. allies or international coalitions, instead describing his foreign policy as, quote, America first.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is a theme that the administration hammers home every time it can. And it's a message they have sent directly to the Iranians is do not open fire on us. Do not come into confrontation with us. If U.S. Servicemen are harmed or killed in the Gulf, then we will come after you. And if the attack comes from Iranian proxies, Shiite militias in the region. So they have been very clear in their messaging is that our threshold for military engagement is if Americans nationals are harmed.
On Monday, Acting Defense Secretary Pat Shanahan announced that 1,000 additional troops would be deployed to the Middle East. What do you think that tells us about the administration's objectives here?
Well, the Pentagon has said that these troops are largely for defensive purposes. They are in terms of surveillance and monitoring and being strengthening the defenses of U.S. around U.S. interests in the region, its bases, their naval vessels, and so on. It's not the sort of number of troops that would be needed if the U.S. had any offensive ambitions. And not a significant number of troops, nor are they, as far as we can see, going to anywhere where they would come into any contact with Iranians. They're not going to Iraq or Syria or Yemen. They are going most likely to one of the U.S. bases on the Gulf, possibly to Al Udeid. Clearly it is a matter of sort of defense, strengthening defenses and sending a signal.
Acting Defense Secretary Pat Shanahan, of course, stepped down on Tuesday, less than 24 hours after the troop announcement, before his final nomination ever went to the Senate. After a background check revealed domestic violence in his family, as reported by the Chicago Tribune and others, setting aside the more tabloid parts of this story, do you believe that this recent upset at the Department of Defense could have any effect on the way the Iran response is rolled out?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the Department of Defense hasn't had a permanent leader since December, and we're in the midst of you know, two potential crises, Iran and also North Korea, and there is no one Senate confirmed at the head of the Defense Department at a critical time. Instead, you have National Security Advisor John Bolton, a kind of ultra salt hawk who is hoarding power and trying to centralize power in the White House, and also a relatively strong State Department. But when it comes to putting the point of view of the U.S. military and laying out what is and what is not militarily feasible, you do not have a strong voice coming from the Pentagon. And that is critical in some of it.
In just the last couple minutes we have here, can you talk about some of the direct ways that the president's decision to pull out of the nuclear deal with Iran is affecting the current situation with that country?
Well, it's not just pulling out, of course. It is the threat to make everyone else walk out of the deal or pull out of the deal. It has involved secondary sanctions being threatened against long-term allies in Europe, as well as against Russia and China. So this has created a kind of pressure cooker inside Iran. The regime is being, the government there is being cordoned up, feeling itself being strangled, and feeling its options being narrowed to where, you know, it either takes all the costs or it lashes out. And also, it is taking away any benefits from Iran sticking to the undertakings it made in 2015 as far as its nuclear program is concerned. And it has threatened that by later this month, it is going to increase its stockpile of low-enriched uranium above the agreed level, which would mark a serious violation from the Iranian point of view. And then in early July, it's threatening to raise the level at which it enriches uranium, which would be a very serious step because it would shrink the amount of time it would take Iran to make a bomb if it so decided to do. Now, that would send red flags, ring alarm bells all around the world and really step this crisis up and make it a nuclear crisis too. So there has been a domino, a knock-on effect from that decision that has brought us to a crisis where there isn't an apparent or clear way off-ramp And it's created a situation in the Gulf that is very, very dangerous.
Thank you so much.
Pleasure.
I've been speaking with Julian Borger, World Affairs Editor for The Guardian and co-author with David Smith of the June 18th article, "Iran Will Not Wage War Against Any Nation," says Hassan Rouhani. You're listening to Trump Watch. My name is Jesse Lent. That's all for this week. Reggie Johnson engineered this program live. You can hear all 118 episodes of Trump Watch with Jesse Lent at soundcloud.com/TrumpWatchWBAI or wherever you get your podcasts. Join us again next week when we'll break down a different aspect of the Donald Trump administration. Until then, I'm your host, Jesse Lent. Talk to you next time. I thought I was.